Welcome back, friends, to the latest edition of the D'Antonio Wingcast. My name is Ben Golver. I'm with Blazers Edge. I am joined by the one and only Kevin Pelton, ESPN.com insider. Kevin, how did we possibly get the clearance from your lawyers to make this podcast happen?
I don't think I'm allowed to acknowledge that I'm on the podcast, so let's just keep this on the down low. But no, this is my Ben, this is always my favorite time of year, and I don't mean opening night. I mean the time we do our one Wingcast annually.
Do we have to come up with like a fake name for you? Are you going to be like Kevin Kelton for the next hour?
Just go with KP2. No one will ever crack that.
Yeah, that's right. Hey, so just real quick, I wanted to get right off the top, just your take. You know, obviously I think the Blazers are going to be number one in pace this year. Wouldn't you agree?
You know, now that George Karl isn't in Denver, maybe there's an opening for that.
I just don't really see anyone going faster than 107 miles per hour.
is there a rim shot we can edit in here?
Hide your wife, hide your kids. Thomas Robinson, Dwight Porsche, fly by us.
You know, the important thing is he was polite with the officers.
Excuse me, sir. I did not realize I was going almost double the speed limit on the freeway. You know, the interesting aspect of that is, you know, they had a security meeting on Friday. So was he doubling the speed limit on his way to the team security meeting? That's the real question. Anyway.
Wouldn't want to be late for that.
No. Hey, I thought Dwight James had actually a really nice piece on just sort of the ramifications of speeding and 25 years later, the tragedy for the Blazers. We're not making light of it, but at the same time, come on, man. You haven't even played in one game yet. You've already got yourself in the crime blotter. Terrible. Terrible.
Yeah, I think the only one person with a worse start in that regard would be Mike Budenholzer.
Yo, yeah, and Mo Cheeks. At least there wasn't any lipstick on a cup inside Thomas Robinson's glass that his girlfriend could find or whatever. I'm sure people hopefully know the story I've talked about with Mo Cheeks in that one. It's pretty ridiculous. But let's move on and talk Blazers. This is our season preview podcast. This is where we're going to dig into the numbers, your incredible Shaney system that not even Carmelo Anthony thinks is accurate. And we'll go through maybe some of the players and expectations and what we expect to see from the team overall. How's that sound?
Yeah, and you can decide which you think is the glitch and which you think is the computer working correctly.
Oh, it's so great that Carmelo Anthony and Mike Woodson both are just being forced to answer a laundry list of questions about Shady. Melo, what do you think Shady is saying this year? It's like, give me a break. Can you just believe Melo's at home having a turkey sandwich? Like, you would not believe what these idiots asked me at practice today. Who is this Kevin Pelton guy? Why does anyone take him seriously?
I believe the expression is, who the hell is Kevin Pelton? But I don't think anyone ever referenced Shaney specifically. They were just told that a computer printed out this projection. And you know, I've discussed this, but that's my favorite part, is assuming that it's like a printout that actually comes out of the computer, and then I look at it, and I'm like, huh, Nick's 37 and 45. What do you know?
Oh, there's no question the computer you use for Shaney probably fills up an entire living room, right? It's like one of those from the 80s that, you know, it spits out like really like one line at a time of code, and it, you know, probably costs $5 million and is bigger than three refrigerators put together.
Well, you would hope it wouldn't have a glitch if it cost $5 million, but I like the idea that it's a complete mainframe.
Well, what does the mainframe have to say about the Blazers? Let's not beat around the bush anymore. Are they going to make the playoffs, or are they not going to make the playoffs, KP?
Well, you know, I think it says pretty much the same thing as conventional wisdom, which is that they're essentially a 500 team. And, you know, whether they make the playoffs, I would say, has as much to do with everybody else in the Western Conference and all these other teams in contention for the eighth playoff spot as it does what they end up doing. So, you know, there's a probability of it, I think about 35%, somewhere in that neighborhood. And it could go either direction.
Are they one injury away? I mean, I know the big storyline in the offseason, we've written about it constantly. It's the new bench, the better depth. But when you look at the key pieces and how indispensable those guys are and what the drop-off is from their backups, you know, from themselves to their backups, are we still looking at basically a team that is, you know, 1 3-week injury to LaMarcus Aldridge from being out of the, you know, playoff chase, or, you know, heaven forbid, the first injury of Damian Lillard's professional career and it's done? Or do you think that they're a little bit better suited than maybe we might expect?
I think you could maybe survive a short-term injury in a way that, you know, you couldn't last year. Like we saw at the end of the season when Batum and Wes Matthews were out of the lineup and LaMarcus Aldridge briefly. And you know, obviously the Blazers weren't really concerned with wins and losses at that point, but the losing streak to end the season was pretty ugly. That was how bad it got when a couple guys were out of the lineup. And this year I think you could actually win a few of those games in that scenario. But, yeah, if you're going to legitimately make a playoff run, you got to keep those guys healthy.
So that's the big X factor here, right? I mean, I think that that's a disqualifier, and it's a pretty obvious one. And I think there's some other teams out there, Dallas, Minnesota. I mean, I think a lot of the teams in that mix are in the same position where, you know, one key injury and, you know, they're not in a position with the depth to sustain it either. So, I mean, I think that's sort of the overarching storyline here for the Blazers, correct?
I would agree with that, yeah. And you know, that we saw that those injuries opened the door to when the Blazers, you know, were sort of in the playoff picture last year. The Dirk Nowitzki being out of the lineup at the start of the year, Kevin Love missing as much time as he did, those were both big factors in it.
Well, the good news for the Blazers is that as an organization, they've never had any history of injuries, and they haven't had any recent injuries.
It's not at all worrisome when a rookie has a foot injury for the Blazers.
Oh, boy, that was pretty brutal. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what his timeline is, you know, CJ McCollum. You know, I think that had they not made that Mo Williams signing, I mean, that's potentially an injury that takes them out of the playoffs, right?
I would agree with that. Yeah, that's, you saw the value in the Mo Williams signing right there in that between Mo and Darrell Wright, I think that the two of them may alone be able to cover for CJ McCollum while he's out of the lineup. And then, you know, you're looking at guys like Alan Crabb, potentially Will Barton, Clavaire. There's still insurance even with that one injury on the perimeter.
Yeah, that turned out to be the clutch move of the summer. We'll get into Darrell Wright later because I think you're Darrell Wright's vice president of his fan club, if I'm remembering right from what the warp numbers were. Oh, you're his agent. That's right. Oh, so you are being paid to actually run these computer models that are ridiculously favorable towards certain people. That's good to know.
So I'm trying to do a CAA type thing where I just run entire organizations.
Okay. Well, no wonder the Knicks don't like you. You're competition. let's talk about the rotation question. First of all, so no questions with Lillard. Maybe some questions with Matthews, but we'll get back to that. No questions with Batum. No questions with Aldridge. No questions with Lopez. So the first real question that Stotts had was backup center, and he finally provided the answer here in the last game of the preseason by putting in Joel Freeland, of all people, a self-described guy who's probably more capable at a power forward position, who was one of the two worst Big Men in the entire NBA last year, besides Brendan Haywood, as his backup over Myers Leonard, a lottery pick, traditional seven forward, athletic skills, pretty solid offensive game, at least for a player of his age, general lack of clue on defense, total awareness issues defensively, but he's been working. What do you make of that decision? And who? And here's the real thing. Does it say more about Freeland or does it say more about Leonard?
First, I would say I feel woefully underqualified to discuss this decision, having seen one of the Blazers' preseason games on TV. And, you know, it's obviously based on what Terry Stotts has seen over the last month or so, because it's certainly not based on what we saw last season from those two guys. But, you know, I think I would say, first off, good for Joel Freeland, who seems to have bounced back. And I thought that he was due to play better this season, that part of what we saw last year was his adjustment period to the NBA. And there is a history of that with international guys, that they tend to be much more effective in year two, even more than you'd expect based on their age. But if he's really ahead of Myers Leonard right now, that's a pretty bad sign for the Blazers. And I guess the other thing that I would be curious your perspective on is, what does that say about the long-term vision of the organization developing young talent versus pushing for a playoff berth right now? Because obviously Myers has more of a long-term future in Portland.
Oh, no question. I think it's your classic case of, like, differing goals here, you know, from different levels of the organization. You've got a coach. And I think rightfully so, he's gunning for every single possible win he can get this year, because I think he realizes after going through two coaching situations and where he didn't make it into year three, that there's a chance he doesn't make it into year three, especially if they don't make the playoffs. So I think what Terry Stotts is doing is, I don't think he's necessarily totally sacrificing the long-term vision or anything like that, but I think he's saying, I'm going to trust my vets. And even though, you know, Freeland's only in his second year, obviously he's got, you know, quite a bit of overall experience and I think a little bit of polish to his game that maybe Myers Leonard doesn't at this point. And I think also just personality-wise, I would say Joel Freeland's a little bit more reliable than Myers Leonard. You don't necessarily know what you're going to get from Myers play to play. He's going to give you those, you know, highs that Joel Freeland's never going to get to, but he's going to give you some pretty bad, pretty ugly lows. And I think with Joel, you know, last year he was really bad, but he was reliably really bad. I mean, there wasn't any situations where it was like, whoa, you're way worse than I thought you were. It's just like, yeah, no, you're one of the worst players in the NBA, but you're one of the worst players in the NBA the same way, kind of time after time, right? And I think, you know, it was pretty clear straight from media day that Freeland came back a different guy. His body looked different. His mentality looked different. I mean, he really lost some confidence, I think, down the stretch, you know, when they were losing all those games in a row, because he just wasn't having any nights where he could really take anything positive from. You know, he was real depressed, real bummed out in the locker room after the game. He just, you know, was kind of saying, I've got to be able to show the coaches what I can do. I got to be able to contribute somehow. I got to stop running into my teammates. I mean, he told me that after one of the games, his goal was to stop running into his teammates. You know, I mean, that's not something you hear from an NBA player very often. And I think, to his credit, I love the decision not to play for Great Britain. Usually I'm all about guys, you know, going and representing their countries. I have no problem with it in terms of the injury standpoint, anything like that. But he realized, like, his professional livelihood was at stake, right? If he was going to make it as an NBA player, this was the year to do it. And it seems to have paid dividends, at least to a certain degree. I don't think it's going to work out very well, though, KP. I don't think he can play five. I think he's too small. I don't think he's long enough. I think you can kind of get away with it in certain situations. But also, you know, a guy like Lopez, and I talked to Coach Stotts about this the other day at practice. I asked him, how many minutes can you reasonably expect from Lopez? And he said, you know, we're going to play him as many as he can handle. But he says, not only are there, you know, the health issues of, you don't want to run a big man totally into the ground right off the bat, but he says, you know, there's also diminishing returns too. You know, he doesn't necessarily feel like a guy who is a little bit of a plotter in Lopez, I think everybody would agree about that, can necessarily sustain a high level play for 35 minutes a night. And I think most people would agree with that, but that also tells you that all of a sudden you're going to really need to rely on either Freeland for a big chunk of rotation minutes, or you're going to have to go small. I think most of us would agree that probably going small is the way to do it, but that comes with its own questions about, you know, can you get Aldridge to buy in, and is there anybody else you can go small with? And there's really not. You know, you can't really go small with Robinson. You know, they don't really have anybody else that you can put in there at the five to do it. So they're at least going to start, you know, relying on Freeland. But to me, that move, it says everything about Myers Leonard's progress or lack thereof, and also possibly about his attitude. You know, I think Myers, in terms of how he handled that situation, he was a total pro about it. He answered every single question I asked him. I went after him a little bit. I tried to ask him, you know, kind of poke and prod and see, okay, how do you really feel about it? He handled it perfectly. But at the same time, the big takeaway was he was totally caught off guard. He was surprised that he had been demoted. He didn't see it coming. And that tells you something that, you know, he's not necessarily on the same page in terms of his self-perception as the coaching staff is. And he's also not necessarily maybe getting feedback along the way from the coaches who are saying, hey, you need to do A, B, and C to make sure you stay our backup center. So to me, that was all very surprising and very newsworthy. And it's going to be interesting to see, can he claw his way back in? Because this guy needs to play, like you were talking about earlier. You can't have, I mean, number one, last year I thought he should have been playing way more minutes instead of Hickson, just because it was a developmental year, throw it away. So, they, you know, they lost potential development time there. You want him to be playing a meaningful role this year if you're going to continue to develop him towards where you think he can be in years 3, 4, 5, and 6, right? And I don't think there's any situation where this can be a lost year. Even if your goal is to make the playoffs and you're going all out for it, you got to make sure you get some sort of level of participation in the rotation, don't you think?
I do, and I think at this point it's not probably too early to start to wonder how much you have to temper those expectations for down the road. You know, is this a guy who, based on what we've seen, can potentially be the answer as a starting center for the Portland Trailblazers? And, you know, I would have to lean towards no at this point in time, which I think you're already on the clock. You know, Robin Lopez has 2 years left on his deal, but you're already looking down the road for who that next guy could be, even in Myers Leonard's second year, and that's problematic.
And not only is everybody as a whole, you know, the collective you that you're talking about, looking down the road, but he was too. I mean, I talked to him that media day, and I said, hey, man, are you going to be pushing for the starting job? He's like, yeah. And that's what he told me at the end of last season, too. He said, I'm going to do it. You know, I'm trying. I'm not going to give it up. I'm going to make my case. So he's coming in thinking year two he could potentially be a starter. Now he's sitting there looking like, hey, I'm on the outside looking in. What do I do? That's tough. I mean, that's a mental challenge, and he's going to have to fight through it. I don't want to write Myers Leonard off yet. You know, I'm not necessarily sure he's ever going to totally get it defensively. But I think that there is enough there still, you know, to potentially be a top 30 center in the NBA. I don't think that's the highest of all bars. You know, I think it's probably easier to be a starting center if you're solid on defense and kind of lacking on offense. And the fact that he's sort of the opposite, where he's solid on offense and lacking on defense, makes it a little bit more difficult, because you got to find the right coaching situation where you can have a little bit of leeway. And you got to find the right band of teammates too, because if he was on a team where they didn't have, you know, three or four other scoring options on the court at all times, like the Blazers do, he might be more valuable. They just kind of don't need his scoring, you know. And it almost reminds me a little bit of Channing Frye in terms of, you know, what he was able to do for Portland and just how they didn't really need it. You know, I think that's probably the worst case scenario for him, is he's going to end up bouncing around trying to find the right team that can actually use his skills.
Yeah, you know, I think you have to maybe wonder whether there's a situation where he'd have a better shot at developing if he had that kind of responsibility on his shoulders and was with a team that needed that kind of scoring load in a way the Blazers don't. I mean, you look at the way the rest of this roster is built, it's really set up for a defensive anchor in the middle. And, you know, Robin Lopez may not be that guy, but he's at least the type of guy I think that you would envision in that role. And I'm not sure that Myers is that.
No question. I mean, the one thing that jumps out about Lopez is he is not the Roy Hibbert or Marc Gasol or Joakim Noah or one of these centers where it's like the pain is theirs. If you come in, you know, there's like a buffer around those guys that guys just like don't even try to challenge him at some point because, you know, they're such good defenders on the inside. That's not him, but he's not a guy who gives up free dunks, you know. If he can get across the paint to foul somebody, he will foul somebody. And that's, you know, like you're saying, probably good enough to allow for at least a 500 record this year. I mean, or close. Because, you know, they're going to be able to put some points on the board, and they just got to get rid of, like, the absolute worst defensive breakdowns. And I think a guy who doesn't mind, you know, just decking people to the court, even during preseason games, is going to be of great use to them. And I think, you know, he actually had a pretty slow start that first game against the Clippers, and I was like, oh, boy. Oh, boy.
That's another statement.
He came on a little bit over the course of the preseason to the point where I'm not sure he's going to necessarily stand out as the weak link as much as Hixon did a lot of the time last year.
So you're coming around to where I was on Robin Lopez, is what you're telling me.
No. You're ready to knight Robin Lopez. I mean, Robin Lopez.
Wasn't the long-term answer.
No. Well, you can say whatever you want on the podcast, but what about in the privacy of G-Chat conversation? I'm pretty sure I've heard you say something along the lines of there's a pretty good chance he's the better twin. Pretty sure you've said that.
Imaginary G-Chat conversations between Ben and I. You'll hear that on every D'Antonio Wincast going forward.
No, you are really high on Robin Lopez.
Because of what we just talked about, I think he's a good fit. I mean, for the price. You know, one thing I did on Friday after the Andrew Bogut extension came out is I went through and looked at the price of every starting center in the NBA who's not on a rookie contract. And I think Robin Lopez might be at the bottom of that list. There's probably one or two other guys that are making a tiny bit less, but it's an expensive position. You're an average starter at center is costing you $12 million or so. An adequate starter is costing you $10 million. So when you're shopping at the $5 million range, to get a guy like Robin Lopez is pretty solid, in my opinion.
Okay. Fair enough. But you are just admitting there that he's a below-average starting center.
I am admitting that. I don't think he's the answer, but he's an upgrade on J.J. Hixon, and given what paying him as little as they do allowed them to do the rest of the offseason in terms of building out depth with Mo Williams and Darrell Wright, that's why I like the move.
How dumb is Denver to sign J.J. Hixon? Is that the worst move of the offseason?
You know, we haven't even gotten into New York's offseason, so there's a lot of contenders, but for him to get as much money as he did with, like, it didn't seem like there was any market for him at that point. I don't know who the Nuggets were bidding against. That was the real thing to me.
Do you think that J.J. Hicks ever goes in the locker room and sees Kenneth Fareed and sees Jarrell Arthur and is like, oh, my God, they cloned me. You ever leave?
Yeah, he'd wonder how he ended up with dreadlocks in the Fareed scenario.
Yeah. But, I mean, come on. What are they doing? What a mess. So the other big rotation question I want to run by you, and, hey, look, it's never too early to just grossly speculate, is it?
That's another theme for the podcast.
Oh, for sure, yeah. We don't upgrade any of the technology, and we don't obey any of the laws about reality. We just kind of, you know, exist in our own world and use, you know, telephone software from the 1940s. Do you think we are headed for a scenario where Wesley Matthews loses his starting spot? And here's the way I could see it. Number one, I could see, well, first, Stotts decides Mo Williams is going to close games. So now what do you do? Well, in a lot of cases, that means Wesley probably can't close games, and he's just going to try to use Damian at the two for defense, right? Alternatively, I think that's phase one. I think once they see how that works, and it's been fairly potent between Lillard and Williams, and they're a pretty dynamic offensive pairing. Williams is going to have to figure out who's on his team and who's not on his team, because he's really had a lot of turnover issues during the preseason. Which I suppose we can expect to a certain degree. But he's really going to have to figure out that he plays for the Blazers. Once Mo Williams figures out he plays for the Blazers and not anybody else, I think they're going to be okay with that pairing. I think they're just going to be able to outscore their opponents, you know, based on just sheer weaponry using that group, or at least against, you know, a lot of teams. So at that point, doesn't the next step say, well, why don't we try to use Batum potentially at the two, right, potentially at the three, move Matthews to the reserve two, and go from there. What do you think about that?
Here's why I would be surprised by that. Coaches love consistency. We already talked about this with Joel Freeland versus Myers Leonard, and Wes Matthews is the ultimate consistency guy where you know the level of effort you're going to get from him night in and night out. And I think we're going to find that one of the reasons that Jarrell Wright hasn't been able to hold down a starting job on a regular basis throughout his career is because he tends to be streakier, especially because he relies so heavily on the three-pointer for so much of his offensive value. When those aren't falling, he's not as good. So I think that's why Terry Stotts is going to prefer having him on the bench, even if he cuts into Wesley Matthews' minutes and is going to want Wes in the starting lineup.
Very good counterpoint. Also, there's a little bit of redundancy between Batum and Wright. I think sometimes that can be an asset. I think that sometimes that can kind of be a deficit. And it's not the worst thing in the world if you separate those guys. Then you can kind of get, you know, the same kind of profile for all 48 minutes because you've always got one of them on the court.
It's Nick Batum and Nick Batum Jr. in terms of their statistics, I would say. The other question, I think, going back to the closing lineup, is do you close with Nick at the four and then either, you know, Wes at the three or Wright at the three alongside that smaller backcourt?
You know, I would like to see that. It's just all about what they could talk Aldridge into because he's been so dead set on this whole, like, I want to play four. I need to have the five protecting me thing. It's almost like it's a mental block at this point. I don't know. Maybe that's a little bit strong. But I think he would rather be closing with the true center. And I think that's probably especially true if they're protecting a lead. You know what I mean? Because they feel like, okay, if we get stops, we win. I think, you know, if you're playing from behind and you're trying to catch up, I could totally see Stotts, you know, throwing out those crazy small ball lineups, Nick at four, get all the shooters in there. I could totally see that. But I think a lot of times if they're playing with a lead, I think they're going to, you know, maybe even go big as opposed to going small.
Valid point. I think the one thing I'd say is that, you know, I think a lot of Aldridge's concern is just the pounding he takes at center. So, you know, I think if he's playing 20 minutes a night there, it's different than if he's playing the last 5 minutes there, especially because the game tends to be outside in instead of inside out at that point anyway.
Well, that's true. I mean, as long as they're doing what they're supposed to be doing on defense.
Okay, well.
Sometimes last year it was just inside, inside, inside.
That is true. Let's start with that optimistic belief, since otherwise maybe they're not going to be close games in the first place.
Oh, boy. So what about the idea that Wesley Matthews could be the next guy to go?
You know, I think it may depend on what we see from C.J. McCollum. I mean, I don't know that, again, to use the phrase long-term solution, I don't know if that's Darrell Wright, and it's certainly not Mo Williams in combination with Lillard. So, you know, I think that that's going to be contingent on how quickly C.J. McCollum develops.
I think you're totally right, and I think that injury could have bought West some time, because let's look at number one. Do you know how many guys on the current roster – were not acquired by Neil O'Shea?
Let's see.
Trivia time.
I'm going to guess. Well, are we counting Joel Freeland and Kluivert as being acquired by O'Shea?
Oh, yeah. Those were stroke of genius signings by the current GM. Yeah, we're counting those guys.
I'm going to credit anything I can to KP1. So it would be three. Then it would be Matthews, Batum, and Aldridge, right?
Ding, 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 ding. Correct. And of those three, I mean, which one's the easiest to move? And which one is, you know, sometimes comes up in the discussion of the core and recently maybe hasn't quite always been mentioned in that core group, Wesley Matthews. I think maybe we're talking about it now because he had a pretty preseason, and if he had a great preseason, we would just be saying, oh, pencil him in. That's the guy he's always been. And also, I think, you know, part of it is, you know, if McCollum was around really pushing for minutes, then all of a sudden, you know, maybe that talk would be even greater. But, I mean, I think that's a guy to watch, you know, because if this is going to be a team that wants to make a move, they've got to send something out, and that's basically their only guy they can really expect to get anything from who they're actually going to be willing to part with, don't you think?
I do. Let me turn this around, and what would you be looking for if you're making that kind of move?
Well, that's tough. I mean, that's really tough. I mean, I think probably a big, you know, so you don't have to play Joel Freeland under any circumstances. You know, I'm not a big
Thomas
Robinson
guy. Maybe Matthews and Myers-Leonard?
Yeah, I mean, that could be a package. I mean, I'm not a big Thomas Robinson guy either, you know. I wouldn't, if I was Blazers, I would be thinking I have, you know, basically 1.5 quality bigs right now. You know, Aldridge definitely. And I'd say Lopez is basically a half. You know, ideally he would be a reserve in a perfect world. But I think, yeah, you're looking at maybe those are your pieces. If you want to do something this year, if you kind of want to be one of those teams that goes against the grain and tries to, you know, do a little win-now move when people aren't expecting it. I'm not sure what bigs are out there for that price. You know, Matthews isn't getting paid that much, so it could be hard to get one of those, you know, starting quality centers like you were talking about earlier. So you're going to have to kind of put together a package. But, I mean, I think for the first time really since he's been a Blazer, I think Matthews is probably a name to watch in terms of trade stuff.
Spencer Hawes is a guy who's going to be very much out there.
No.
The upscale Myers Leonard.
Dude, people are going to turn the podcast off if you say stuff like that. You can't just randomly throw out a guy's name like Spencer Hawes without any sort of a warning. You have to have like a 45-second preface where you're like, okay, I know this might not be popular, but – and you have to walk on eggshells as you get to the final delivery. You can't just – this is not Seattle where maybe Spencer Hawes is thought of a little bit more highly. This is Portland, you know. I don't know.
You can edit in like a warning buzzer or something into
explicit language coming. No, not any profanity. Oh, boy. Okay, well, there you go. There's one name out there. We just traded Wesley Matthews for Spencer Hawes. We should put up a poll. How many people would do that? That could break the poll.
It's going to have to be a three-way because Wesley Matthews is way too good for the Philadelphia 76ers.
That's very true. And I think there'd be teams out there that would like Wesley Matthews because of what we're saying. You know, he's fairly consistent. And even if he doesn't shoot that much, like even if he goes to a team where they're saying, hey, we don't want you to shoot nearly as much as you've been shooting in Portland, especially off the dribble, you know, I think he could be a pretty solid guy for a lot of teams. So, who knows? That's the other thing, too, is, like, let's say something terrible does happen, you know, some catastrophic injury to somebody who's important, or they just start off really slow and they don't have it for whatever reason. Not that I'm predicting that, but let's just say that happened. Wouldn't the first guy at the deadline in that scenario to go be Wesley Matthews because you're just trying to get whatever you can for him and play to the future and, you know, look to a world that's going to be centered more around Lillard and McCollum? You know, and
yeah,
maybe
I mean, he's a little older than that, than the rest of that core, especially if you decide at some point way down the road to move on from LaMarcus Aldridge and, yeah, focus on that Lillard, McCollum, Batum group.
All right. I think we've speculated enough about Wes. It's really good to see that everything worked out with his heartbeat. I definitely want to put that out there, the scary situation. Sounds like he's going to be ready for the opener, so that's great news. And, you know, we'll see where his season goes. You know, it was kind of strange. You know, I don't really know what to make of his preseason. You know, we've seen guys struggle through the preseason before. I think most memorably was Brandon Roy. This season, sort of the last good season he had where – or I guess the last season he really played, because it wasn't really a good season, where he just looked terrible in the preseason. And it was like from day one, it was like you couldn't avoid writing about it. It was like he just looks awful. I mean, Wesley hasn't been that. But he also just can't get a shot to fall, you know. And so I don't know. It's weird. He was real frustrated at himself, it seemed like, after a couple of the games in Portland, which is not unusual because, you know, he's very hard on himself, very demanding. So, you know, we'll see whether that was just sort of a, you know, a getting back into the swing of things kind of funk, or whether that's something to track, because, you know, he's been one of the most reliable players for a while now. And they need him. They really need him.
Yeah. Is it possible he's still upset over his NBA rank?
Possibly. He was quite upset about that. How great was it with all the players just getting, you know, Jamal Crawford was the best. I'm going to have my own rankings. That's an overreaction, Jamal. Just because we put you at like 82 on the SI Top 100 does not mean you want to go through the process, which takes just dozens of hours to rank all these guys. Just because you feel like you were slighted, you don't want to go and make your own rankings. Trust me. Just trust me on this. How long does the ESPN process take?
You know, I spent about 5 to 10 minutes on it, I think.
What?
No, I put together a whole spreadsheet, obviously, as you can imagine with me.
Yeah, it's an intensive process. Please tell me it is. I mean, we spent good solid 2 weeks on ours.
I didn't spend 2 weeks on mine, you know, since it's more of the wisdom of the crowds theory. But I don't think either of those guys has as much to complain about as Kent Bazemore last year with the $4.99 in his shoes. That was totally legitimate and kind of awesome.
Kent Bazemore, what great memories from Summer League. Oh, before we start getting nostalgic here and crying, we should probably move on. So who else do we have to cover here? Oh, Thomas Robinson's Fast and Furious.
Too fast, too furious.
I have had an NBA executive communicate with me on multiple occasions that he's pretty confident that Thomas Robinson is not an NBA player.
Wow.
That's pretty harsh.
That's too harsh.
I think so too. What kind of a player is he? If he is an NBA player, how good can he be?
I mean, you know, I think I've been pretty consistent about this maybe since last year's trade deadline. I think that he's kind of in a more skilled Reggie Evans, which is not the most glowing praise for the 5th overall pick, but, you know, Reggie Evans has carved out, what, now a 12-year NBA career for himself. So there's a place in the league for somebody like that if he understands and knows his role, and that just continues to be the question, it seems like, from game to game.
It definitely is. It doesn't necessarily seem like he's found the comfort factor within Portland's offense yet. And I think that is probably a function of the preseason just being kind of a crapshoot, especially for Portland with how many injuries they've had. You know, guys have been in and out. The time he looked the most comfortable by far was when he started. And I tried to give him the question of like, hey, is this why you were so comfortable? Because you were starting just like, you know, back at Kansas or whatever. And he didn't bite on that at all. I mean, he's like, hey, look, I totally understand what my role is. I'm going to have to figure out how to do it off the bench. And he also seemed to kind of be admitting like he hadn't quite figured out how to do it off the bench yet, which I think is fair. I think it's going to take time. You know, the tricky part is like trying to remember not to do too much. You know, that seems to be where he really gets into a lot of trouble. And I think he can do too much because he was so talented at the college level. I think now when he's in the NBA, he can do too much in so many different ways that it almost leaves this really bad impression on his overall game. That's maybe unfair. Because he will do too much and turn the ball over. He will do too much and get his shot blocked. He will do too much and take really bad-looking shots. He will do too much and dribble himself into tight spaces and kind of break down a possession. You know, all of those things, they really just jump out, and it's tough because he is doing a lot when he's off the ball, you know, in terms of trying to hit the glass. He's worked fairly well on the defensive end. You know, I think one thing that surprised me is, you know, you hear so much about his physique. I'm not sure he holds his position against fours defensively as well as maybe he should. I don't know if that's a technique thing or a size thing or what, but I think, you know, that's going to be an issue for him because he's not super long. You know, guys can kind of get, you know, they can get started pretty low on the block with him and put him at a real disadvantage defensively. So there's been some concerns on both ends for me, but the number one thing is not trying to do too much. And I think everybody realizes it. I mean, it seems like, you know, he gets it. They've been telling him, his teammates have been telling him, his coaching staff's been telling him. So I think that's really what I'm interested to watch between, say, now and Christmas with Thomas Robinson is, okay, how does that play out? How does he process the idea that he knows he's doing too much and he needs to chill out? Because I don't necessarily think Stotts is really going to have a lot of patience for that stuff. You know, I think it's similar to the whole Myers-Leonard thing. It's like, okay, if you're going for the reliable Joel Freeland over Myers-Leonard, the same things that Myers can do to maybe aggravate you, especially on defense, are some of the same things, you know, potentially that Robinson's doing on offense, just in terms of not understanding what he's, you know, his mission is out there and sticking tightly to it. And I think, you know, why would you treat Robinson any differently than Leonard? Does that make sense?
Yeah, especially when you don't have as much invested in him and he's not really as important to your future in many ways as Leonard. So, you know, I think that it's the old coaching adage that the bench is your best teacher. Like, I think Thomas Robinson is going to find out that in order to play minutes, he has to play a certain way. And if he doesn't play that way, he's going to be watching.
And I think that's going to get really sticky. And the reason why I say that is because of the tone he's kind of struck over those last two stints in Sacramento and Houston. It's like he feels personally aggrieved, you know. He has internalized that, and he is not happy about it. And that can be great fuel, great positive fuel, if he's getting minutes and he's being productive and he's figuring out how to do it and he's sticking to Stotts' command. And that could be a potentially really bad situation if he's not able to be doing what he's supposed to do and he's also not necessarily getting the time. That time is being taken back away from him. I think that could be, you know, a real risk. And so that's another thing to watch here over the couple, you know, first couple months of the season is how does he acclimate? Is he able to, you know, kind of stay on the good side, stay out of the doghouse? Because I think that's really going to determine potentially not only for this season, but going into the future, whether this can kind of be a successful fit, the kind of fit that Neil O'Shea has been saying it would. I think we're going to get some pretty good answers to that over the first couple months of the season.
And the good thing is, you know, you picked up his option for next year, but you weren't going to have cap space then anyway. You know, the downside is probably pretty limited in his case. You didn't give up too much to get him. And the upside is there is still the talent in there that, I mean, this guy was the number five pick, you know, 15 months ago, as hard as that is sometimes to believe.
No doubt. And I think the Blazers are at the point, though, they're taking a lot of, you know, cracks at guys, you know, taking some pretty good low-risk shots. At some point, those shots have to pay off, though, right, if you're going to go anywhere. I mean, Thomas Robinson's a move that needs to pay off for the Blazers. If it doesn't pay off, they've just wasted a lot of time.
You know, one or two of them need to pay off. You know, I think that's why you get a portfolio of those guys and hope the ones that pan out offset the guys that don't.
Because we are in the same conversation about J.J. Hicks. He just wasted, you know, 15 months of his life and everybody else's lives.
You know, he did average a double-double last year. You couldn't get value for him at the deadline. That was the killer in his case. That you just let him walk for nothing, unfortunately.
That's what I'm saying. And I think that's a potential situation here with Robinson, too. It's like, okay, you picked up his option. Let's say he's solid but not spectacular. You know, then what? You know, what's the end game? I mean, where are you trying to go with this? I mean, you really need to hit a home run on one of these to, you know, meaningfully impact, you know, the franchise's ceiling here. And I think he's the guy that a lot of people have circled as being the most likely to be able to be a home run, right?
Yeah. I think he's got the most upside of them. So, but sometimes you got to go through a lot of misses. I mean, you know, look at Houston a few years ago when they had Ashim Thabeet, Johnny Flynn, Terrence Williams all on the roster. But you churn through those, and the next year you hit on, you know, you hit on a Kyle Lowry and you hit on a Chandler Parsons, and all of a sudden you parlay those. I mean, that's the idea, is that eventually you got to come up with some hits, but it takes some misses to get there.
Good point. Good excuse making. Anybody else on the roster that has struck your eye? Did we talk about how much you like Darrell Wright? Can you explain to people why Darrell Wright's warp? Well, first of all, quickly summarize warp again for people who don't know, which is probably zero people listening to this podcast. But then why was he such a warp hero?
We may have new listeners. That's wins above replacement player. And, you know, it starts out with a permanent rating that's sort of similar to PER or win shares on a permanent basis, and then compares that to a theoretical replacement level, which is the kind of guy you can call up from the D-League or sign to a 10-day contract, that sort of thing. And you get credited for how much value you provide above that kind of player or below, as the case may be, and how long you're able to stay on the floor. So anyway, Darrell Wright rates very well on a permanent basis because two of the things that tend to be very valuable in warp. Number one, there's an adjustment for the number of three you attempt as a percentage of your total plays, because guys that are taking a lot of shots from beyond the three-point line and spending most of their time there tend to draw the defense toward them and open up the offense for everyone else. And then the other thing is steals are an important component in the defensive rating of warp. And so guys who come up with a lot of steals and make a lot of threes, doing both of those, have both of those skills, tend to come out very well, and that's true of both Darrell Wright and Nick Batum.
So it seems to me like you should be a lot more excited about the potential Batum-Wright combo starting together than you are.
I mean, it's, you know, you're right that it's a little bit of a redundancy, and you like to have both those guys, one of those guys on the floor at all times, but yeah, you put the two of them together, I mean, yeah, that's a lot of three-point shooting on the floor and a lot of length on the wing, too.
And it's like, if you start both of them, you got Damian who can handle the rock, right? And if you need to take some of the load off Damian, then you can stagger that with him however you want to do it. But it's not like you're going to need necessarily a second ball handler to come save him, because that's sort of the big weakness of that lineup, right? It's like, you don't want Nicholas Batum dribbling the ball up the court, because he still has not discovered that he owns a left arm, which is a big issue when you're trying to dribble in the NBA if you only have one arm. So, and I don't think necessarily Wright and all of his talk about trying to be a point forward, I don't think I see that. So
that can pass it pretty well. I think they pass it better than they dribble it.
I agree. And I would say both of them are fine moving the ball around and, you know, in a motion heavy offense. I don't have any problem playing them together. I'm saying the big weakness, though, is like you've only got one ball handler, right? So if you were going against a team that could really pressure and take Lillard off the ball, that's where that lineup would struggle. And not that Wesley's necessarily that much better. But, and maybe that's a good reason why they should look at it, going with Wright and Batum together, because, you know, the downgrade from, you know, having Wesley in that situation to the other guys isn't great. But I think that's the big weakness of that lineup, right? Everything else is money, because you've got the length, you've got the versatility, you've got the interchangeability on defense between those two. You could switch everything if you need to. You've got all sorts of shooting, potentially better shooting than Matthews is going to give you. And, you know, you've got lots, I mean, I think I keep coming back to it, but length, you know, you've got a lot more length out there. And I think, you know, maybe it's a little bit of a, you know, recency bias, because they did break this out in the preseason a little bit, but boy, those guys can swarm, you know, like you got all those, you got 14 feet of arms between those two guys. It's like they're everywhere. And it's noticeably different. So I don't know. It's an interesting combination. I don't know if they'll go to it, but I could see, you know, if they do struggle a little bit. I mean, I think that's the next obvious lineup juggle move. I don't see anything else really out there. I don't think you're going to probably bring Mo in to start. So that's sort of the move, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess I'd say the reason I'm not more excited about it is just the fact that I've seen Darrell Wright play behind Damian Wilkins and guys like that in the past. You know, there's been coaches who have been reluctant to use him, and I until I see Terry Stotts give him 25, 30 minutes a game, I'm going to assume that he's going to fall in that category again.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm just trying to, you know, pursue all angles here, because otherwise we don't really have anything to talk about. Okay.
Well.
Anything else that we haven't covered on the Blazers that was in any of your preview stuff that you'd like to bring to our attention?
I mean, I think Have we talked about the stat on the how many wins below replacement level the bench was last season?
Please break it out.
10 wins below replacement level, the second lowest combined total of all non-starters in Warp goes back to 1977-78. So in that entire time span, the Blazers had the second worst benches is rated that way, ahead of only the post lockout 98-99 Chicago Bulls, who went like, you know, 13-37 or something.
You know how there was, you could tell if there was a bad bench? When Google Translate, when you're trying to like look up last year's bench players, and Google Translate needs to like install plugins for the languages. when they're not common languages like Spanish, French, and you got to try to track down Babbitt info, Nolan Smith. I'm not sure he's even playing on this planet. He could be in the Moon League for all I know. You're trying to like look up information about last year's players, and Google Translate needs to install new language plugins. That's how you know you had a bad bench.
Well, you know, since it's kind of a tradition that he takes a lot of abuse on this podcast, unfortunately, when you were thinking about how Joel Freeland was reliably bad, I was thinking about who was the guy who was unreliably bad, and I guess that was Nolan, because sometimes he was just so awful, it was unbelievable.
I'm going to tell my yet-to-be-born grandchildren, I mean, I haven't made any progress on the grandchildren front, but I almost want to have grandchildren just so I could tell them about Nolan Smith's minus 17 in 3 minutes game. That may be one of the greatest moments in NBA history. I mean, Ray Allen's shot was pretty good. Speaking from experience, seeing that in person was pretty good. Michael Jordan shoving Brian Russell, pretty good. Nolan Smith minus 17 in 3 minutes is up there among the greatest NBA performances in the history of the league.
I mean
it was just unbelievable.
The championship every year.
It's
how often does that happen?
You know, Brandon Jennings, if he had played his cards right, I don't think he could have played his cards worse last year in terms of, okay, where am I going to play for? What kind of contract am I going to get? I'm going to just totally antagonize the Bucks. So they don't want to bring me back and then just get stuck in the free agency limbo. And then nobody really wants me because I'm such a head case. And finally, Joe Dumars just gets desperate and decides to throw money at me. And it's not really that much money, not nearly as much as he probably should have been making or what he was expecting to making or what he already turned down from the Bucks the previous year. He should have tried to renegotiate his deal right after that game because Brandon Jennings looks like the greatest point guard in the history of the NBA after that game against Nolan Smith. They should have tried to open up a 24-hour negotiating window. He probably could have got max.
Maybe that was his entire highlight film that they sent around to teams.
Oh, you've heard a lot of bad things about my client. He hates Milwaukee. He doesn't want anything to do with the small market. He rushed to L.A. in a second. Oh, by the way, he also locked down completely Nolan Smith, took him out of the game, 17 points in 3 minutes. Oh, God, the memories. Yeah, well, we don't have to worry about that guy anymore. The backup point guard situation is definitely one of the better, more stable situations since I think I've been covering the team over the last couple of years. Having Mo is really a difference maker in terms of, you know, you don't go through the, like, just automatic stress increase that would happen with Sergio Rodriguez and Armand Johnson, you know, and guy after guy. I mean, okay, the Blake-Andre combo was pretty solid, even though they never really made the best out of it. But other than that, this Lillard, Williams, McCollum, not too bad.
Are you even mentioning Earl Watson?
No, I'm not going to acknowledge that he's on the team. Because I just don't want to have to watch that guy play. He was one of the worst guys in the NBA last year. I mean, he was down there in that PER zone with all those negative warp guys that you were talking about. Joel Freeland. I mean, that's sort of the Earl Watson term. I mean, Ronnie Price, you know. I think Earl Watson might actually be Ronnie Price.
Well, his role on the team, his spot on the depth chart is not at point guard. It is veteran leader.
No question. They also had him ball hawking, which was pretty entertaining. Like during the preseason, he was applying a one-man full-court pressure, which wasn't working. Surprise, surprise. They tried, though. But, yeah, no, I'm not sure how much he's going to play this year, which is good. I think they're pretty solid, though, in the backcourt. Even without McCollum, I think they'll be okay. I think all in all, the team over the course of the preseason looked slightly better than I thought they would, which I think is good. You know, it's been a few years.
Are you revising your prediction upwards?
I mean, the whole one injury away thing has got me nervous with these guys because, like, the Clippers just made them look like a JV team when they were playing that preseason game without Aldridge. And granted, that's going to happen. The Clippers are really good. But, I mean, it was kind of flashbacks to last year's, the lowest moments of last year. So that's got me on edge a little bit. But, you know, I definitely think it's going to be a much, much, much more entertaining team than last year by leaps and bounds. I mean, last year we really were, you know, looking for ways to entertain ourselves. And I think this way, this season, it's actually the basketball is going to be pretty entertaining. And the offense is fun to watch, you know. I mean, they've got the guys shooting. They haven't even shot the ball that well during the preseason. But there's going to be some explosive, you know, possibilities here. They could put up 120 without, you know, that many insane things happening. And that's good.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like the offense is a lock. It's really just a question of the defense. And, you know, I picked the Blazers for 41 wins, and I feel like there's almost no chance of them winning exactly 41, though. It's like either they win 44 or 45 and make the playoffs, or it's a scenario where they're out of the playoff race a little bit and they end up winning like 38 or 39 and picking 11th.
Yeah, I could see that. So you're basically saying deja vu or blow everybody's mind.
Yep, one of the two.
Well, that sounds
probably
like
about equally likely, too.
Well, perfect. There you go. That's a good way to wrap this up. You heard it here first. The computer is completely hedging its bets. And it is predicting either triumph or despair or somewhere in between. That is the 2013-14 Portland Trail Blazers. KP, it's been fun. We'll look forward to talking to you a year from now.
Yeah, I can't wait until our annual podcast. Mixtapes, CEOs heard, now here come big cake. But one cat said, Cam, you better recoup, for you back on your block, baby, dead on your stoop. But unhook me up with all this cheddar and loot, the best rap deal of all time next to Snoop. Money more to clutch, money more to touch, I don't just rhyme, I own liquor stores and such. But yeah, yo, the rap game remind me of the crack game. Niggas wanna get their gun, then start the clap game for that fame. Grow entertainment, sports, drugs, entertainment, to the arraignment killer. Street.